talking about Yayati, remember? Yayati and how he had his difficulty in life and found, who was it that he found in the well? Sarmista and their friend, and then Sarmista and Devayani, they had a little contentious relationship, and they were friends, but they had some problems. And so when Devayani, was it Sarmista in the well? Devayani was in the well, wasn't it? No, because Devayani's this daughter of Sukracharya. Yeah, Devayani was in the well. Sarmista threw Devayani. Sarmista threw Devayani in the well. Thank you. Now we have our pundit here. Okay. So Devayani was the daughter of Sukracharya. So her father, being very powerful, he was a man to contend with. So when Yayati offended Sarmista by having sex with Devayani, then Sukracharya cursed Yayati to become an old man. So then he had to search out from his sons if they would exchange his old age for his youth, their youth for his old age. Did you go through that whole story? Okay. All right, so now we're on the descendants of Puru, because Puru was the son of Yayati, the good son of Yayati, who was willing to exchange his youth for his father's old age for a certain time, and then his father gave him back his youth, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, so if you remember, when you hear about Krishna's dynasty, you often hear about the Yadus, the Purus. This is descendants of the Puru dynasty. And one of the points, now here in this ninth canto, there's lots of, and this person had this person for a son, and he had this person for a son, and he had this. And there are people you never, ever heard of, a lot of them. You know, some of them are more famous than others. But actually, the point of that is to understand how time passes so quickly. In our life, we're thinking it's so important and everything's so dramatic. And in a few years, no one's going to even remember our name. In a very few years. Because we're not going to even make our name in the Bhagavatam. At least you read these names and you think, okay, well, he was in the Bhagavatam. Okay, Janmanjaya, this one, that one. No one's going to read our names in the Bhagavatam, that's for sure. Time goes so quickly. We're thinking otherwise, but time goes so quickly. And there's so much of it. There's so much time. We're thinking it's here and now, this is it. You know, it's all in all. But there's so eternal time. Has a way of being a long time, you know. So hearing the descendant after descendant after descendant, it's supposed to make one thoughtful. How this life is very fleeting, and we have this opportunity. So let's try to take advantage of it by being serious about spiritual life. And whatever progress is made in our spiritual life, that's what our gain is at the end of life. Our gain isn't necessarily our degree, our this, our money, how many kids we, whatever, what we accomplish. That's not necessarily our gain if it's not, oh, Hari Bol, good to see you. Oh, see you soon. After a long time. Oh, sorry. Our gain isn't necessarily these things unless they're related to Krishna. Our gain is what progress we make in spiritual life. Time is rolling by very quickly, unrelentlessly, and we're just a little speck, even though we think we're so important. What to speak of, even if we are important, you're still a little speck, and in 100 years, nobody even remembers your name. Text one. We'll go around the room doing it. There'll be some names of people and some things. Okay, you want to? Oh, do we have a. Want to start there then? Yeah, start on your side.
Sukadev Goswami said, O Maharaj Pariksit, descendant of Maharaj Bharat, I shall now describe the dynasty of Puru in which you were born, in which many saintly kings appeared, and from which many dynasties of Brahmanas began.
Just another point is, we're hearing these descriptions of these dynasties, and very soon we're going to hear how Krishna, you know, which family line he came in. He came in this family line, the Purus, the Yadus. So it's actually all getting us prepared to understand the birth of Lord Krishna. Okay, Zach.
King Janmanjaya was born of this dynasty of Puru. Janmanjaya's son was
Prachinvan,
and his son was Pravira. Thereafter, Pravira's son was Manusu, and from Manusu came the son named Charupada.
Charupada. So there's going to be lots of names like that. Okay, Nimai Pandit.
The son of Charupada was Sadyu, and the son of Sadyu was Bahugava. Bahugava's son was Samyati. From Samyati came a son named Abhayati, from whom Rudrashva was born.
Rudrashva had 10 sons named Ratayu, Kasheyu, Standaleyu, Kritayuka, Jaleyu, Santayu, Dharmayu, Satyayu, Ratayu, and Vanayu. Of these 10 sons, Vanayu was the youngest. As the 10 senses, which are products of the universal life, act under the control of life, these 10 sons of Rudashva acted under Rudashva's full control. All of them were born of the Apsara named Gritachi.
Rayu had a son named Rantanav, who had 3 sons named Sumati, Dhruva, and Aparita. Aparita had only 1 son whose name was Kanva.
Seven.
The son of Kanva was Medatiti, whose son, all Brahmanas, were headed by Prashana, the son of Rantinava, named Sumati, who had a son named Redbhi. Maharaj Dushmanta is well known as the son of Redbhi.
So here we're going to start hearing about Maharaj Dushmanta. That's our little storyline for today. It's quite interesting.
Once, when King Dushmanta went to the forest to hunt and was very much fatigued, he approached the residence of Kanva Muni. There he saw a most beautiful woman who looked exactly like the goddess of fortune and who sat there illuminating the entire ashram by her effulgence. The king was naturally attracted by her beauty, and therefore he approached her, accompanied by some of his soldiers, and spoke to her.
So the setting is a little familiar. The king is off in the forest hunting. He gets a little tired. He goes to the sage's ashram. We've heard that story in different ways. So here we're going to get Maharaj Dushmanta's story.
Seeing the beautiful woman, the king was very much enlivened, and the fatigue of his hunting excursion was relieved. He was, of course, very much attracted because of lusty desires, and thus he inquired from her as follows, in a joking mood.
Oh, beautiful lotus-eyed woman, who are you? Whose daughter are you? What purpose do you have in the solitary forest? Why are you staying here?
All very logical questions.
O most beautiful one, it appears to my mind that you must be the daughter of a Kshatriya. Because I belong to the Puru dynasty, my mind never endeavors to enjoy anything irreligiously.
That's an interesting little piece of information there. So she's in the ashram of Kanva Muni, so it's obviously it's a Brahminical setting. But he, because he's a righteous king, I mean, he's attracted to this woman, but not in an irreligious way, although might appear that to our eyes, but still. So he says, there must be some Kshatriya line in you, because it would be irreligious for a Kshatriya king, he's Dushmanta's in the Kshatriya line, to be attracted to a Brahmin's daughter. That's not the usual way things go. She's in a higher caste. So he says, no, there must be something in the Kshatriya line in you, because I'm not attracted to anything irreligious.
Can I ignore it?
But that is a polite way of saying
that. Oh, yeah. He'll say it more direct also. They're very upfront.
Shakuntala said, I am the daughter of Vishwamitra. My mother Menaka left me in the forest. O hero, the most powerful saint, Kanva Muni knows all about this. Now let me know, how may I serve you?
So here, just for your... So Vishwamitra was also a Brahmin, but originally he was a Kshatriya. Vishwamitra was a king, and he had his thing with... Who was it his thing with? No, Vishwamitra was always fighting with Vashishta. And so they had their thing. So Vashishta was a Brahmin, Vishwamitra was a Kshatriya, and Vashishta was showing his Brahminical tejas, his Brahminical power. Vashishta was defeated by that. This goes back many thousands of years. And so he wanted to become a Brahmin. Vishwamitra wanted to become a Brahmin, so he performed austerities to get Brahminical power. So, although he acts in many Brahminical roles, originally he comes from a Kshatriya line. So, it proves the point of Dushmanta's point. You must have Kshatriya blood in you, to Shakuntala, who is the daughter of Vishwamitra, and who's the mother? Menaka. Menaka, Apsara from the heavenly planets, when anyone is performing the austerities, we know that if they get very, very powerful, some people get nervous, like Indra gets nervous that this person's going to take over my post, and therefore he always tries to sabotage the mission, and usually just by sending a young, beautiful girl, it does the trick. So he sent Menaka. Vishwamitra was distracted, and from their union, who was born? Vishwamitra and Menaka, who was born? Shakuntala. And this is the beautiful girl that's now in Kanva Muni's ashram. Because the mother didn't want to raise her, because the mother was from the heavenly planet. She didn't want to stay here on the earth. She did her mission, and that was fulfilled. She wanted to go back to the heavenly planet. And Vishwamitra, he didn't want to raise her. So they left her in the forest. Now, isn't that pretty cruel? What do you think about that? What's your impression on that? To die in the forest. Yeah. Shakuntala? I have to admit, I can't remember that part, but I'm not denying it. But also, sometimes if we think in one way, we think of, like, in relation to us, you know, if we would do something like that, it would be like this. But actually, they were thinking, everyone is protected and provided for by the Lord. So she'll be, something will happen, the Lord will provide for her. Some arrangement. You know, so sometimes, like this whole story, if we look at it through the eyes of a conditioned soul in the year 2011, you get a certain slant on it. But that's not the most proper way to look at it. Looking at it through the eyes of the scriptures and those personalities, great souls, they were great souls, and they were saintly. They had a different understanding, and therefore it wasn't child neglect, it wasn't abusive, it wasn't terrible, they had an understanding that this person has her destiny, she's going to be provided for very nicely by the Supreme Lord. And she was. Kanva Muni took care of her and wasn't disturbed at all by it. Mr. Damodar?
O king with eyes like the petals of a lotus, please come sit down and accept whatever reception we can offer. We have a supply of Nivara rice that you may kindly take. And if you so desire, stay here without hesitation.
So you can see she's not particularly opposed to talking to the king or establishing a relationship.
She's the mother of Bharat, right? She becomes,
excuse me?
She becomes the mother of Bharat.
You're going to hear it. Mm-hmm. And his name is Bharat. Bharat is in tomato sauce. Go on.
What?
Bharats are made of dal, and they're ground into ground together and they're made into, and they're cooked in tomato sauce, Bharats. And his name was, no, Bharata and Bart. Okay, go on.
Bart.
Sorry.
King Dushmanta, Dushmanta replied, "Oh Shankuntala, with beautiful, that's where we are?
Yeah.
With beautiful eyebrows, you have taken your birth in the family of the great saint Vishvamitra, and your reception is quite worthy of your family. Aside from this, the daughters of a king generally select their own husbands."
He's getting right to the point. He's attracted to her. Okay, Zach, you get the next verse.
When Shakuntala responded to Maharaj Dushmanta's proposal with silence, the agreement was complete.
In other words, she didn't protest. He's asking her. He's asking her in a nice way. You know, you can choose your own husband. In other words, will you choose me as your husband? Since she didn't say no, it meant she agreed.
Then the king, who knew the laws of marriage, immediately married her by chanting the Vedic Pranava
Omkar.
In accordance with the marriage ceremony as performed among the Gandharvas.
Okay, so I'm going to read the purport here. Let's go back a little bit. When Dushmanta says to Shakuntala, you can choose your own husband, that's referring to the Swayamvara ceremony. So in the Swayamvara ceremony, when the young girl is particularly qualified, then she can choose from qualified men who she wants to be her husband, which is not that's an extraordinary example. The more common example is that the marriage is arranged, but if the girl is really qualified, she can choose who she wants. And then you remember of Draupadi Swayambara, this one Swayambara, so many things. They had to prove their prowess, if that's what her desire was, to have the most powerful, the best of this. But here in the purport, okay, thanks. Because, again, in the eyes of a conditioned soul in 2011, we see things one way. But let's try to see things through the scriptures. And see, he's, Maharaj Dushmanta, consummates the marriage by chanting the Vedic Pranava Omkar. And we might think, well, that's pretty quick. Ari Om. And he's got a wife, you know. But actually, what he's doing here, it'll be explained here in the report. I'll read that, okay? The Omkar, Pranava, is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, represented by letters. So he knew full well that he was calling the presence of the Supreme Lord in the form of this vibration of Om, this three letters, sacred letters, to be witness to this sacred and bless this sacred union. Even though in our eyes we see it in a little different way, okay? Bhagavad Gita says that the letters A, U, M combined together as Om represent the Supreme Lord. Religious principles are meant to invoke the blessings and mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, who says in Bhagavad Gita that he is personally present in sexual desires that are not contrary to religious principles, okay? The word vidhina means according to religious principles. The association of men and women according to religious principles is allowed in the Vedic culture. You notice how no one's sleeping in this class? Okay. In our Krishna consciousness movement, we allow marriage on the basis of religious principles. But sexual combination of men and women as friends is irreligious and not allowed. Okay. Nimai Pandit Prabhu?
King Dushmanta, who never discharged semen without a result, placed his semen at night in the womb of his queen, Shakuntala, and in the morning he returned to his palace. Thereafter, in due course of time, Shakuntala gave birth to a son.
So he left right away. He had things to do, but we'll see what happens. Okay.
In the forest, Kanva Muni performed all the ritualistic ceremonies concerning the newborn child. Later, the boy became so powerful that he would capture a lion and play with it.
So interestingly enough, even though King Dushmanta left after that one meeting with Shakuntala, one evening with Shakuntala, It wasn't like he abandoned her. He didn't abandon religious duties. Neither did she. And the child was raised. The child was born, and Kanva Muni performed all religious ceremonies. It wasn't an unwanted child. It wasn't neglected. It wasn't abandoned. It wasn't seduced and abandoned. Remember that one? Okay, that was an oldie. But okay, go on.
Shakuntala, the best of beautiful women, along with her son, whose strength was insurmountable and who was a partial expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, approached her husband, Dushmanta.
Interesting, isn't it? So the son born is a partial expansion of the Supreme Lord, Bharat. And he was so strong that he actually, it was a little problem. It was a problem to have him in the forest because he was so strong and so young that he would go and, you know, play with the tigers and wrestle the tigers and do all sorts of unusual things. And so again, it wasn't an irreligious combination, and the child was actually an expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Mr. Baladev?
When the king...
Okay, one sorry, because since I'm interrupting all the time. So Shakuntala has the son, the boy grows some, you know, a little bit. You know, he's just still a young boy, a toddler. Shakuntala goes to the king now with her son and approaches the king. Here's what happens when she approached the king. Okay, Baladev.
When the king refused to accept his wife and son, who were both irreproachable, and an embodied voice spoke from the sky as an omen and was heard by everyone present.
So the king, obviously, here comes this woman into the palace audience with the son, and she's saying, you know, I'm your wife, this is your son, please accept us. And the king refuses. That's also reminiscent of... Was he cursed? No, he wasn't cursed. Baladev? Actually, I'll read the purport, okay? Okay, here's the purport. But don't forget he had other wives, too, and other children, too, because that was also acceptable. But anyway, here's the purport. Maharaj Dushmanta knew that Shakuntala and the boy were his own wife and son. But because they came from outside and were unknown to the citizens, he first declined to accept them. Shakuntala, however, was so chaste that an omen from the sky declared the truth so that others could hear. When everyone could hear from the omen that Shakuntala and her child were truly the king's wife and son, the king gladly accepted them. Okay.
The voice said, O Maharaj Dushmanta, a son actually belongs to his father, whereas the mother is only a container, like the skin of a bellows. According to Vedic injunction, the father is born as the son. Therefore, maintain your own son and do not insult Shakuntala.
So you can imagine how chaste and powerful Shakuntala was to have a demigod, an unembodied voice. It was a demigod. It was somebody stick up for her.
O King Dushmanta, he who discharges semen is the actual father, and his son saves him from the custody of Yamaraja. You are the actual creator of this child. Indeed, Shakuntala is speaking the truth.
Shukadev Goswami said, when Maharaj Dushmanta passed away from the earth, his son became the emperor of the world, the proprietor of the seven islands. He is referred to as a partial representation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in this world.
Okay, so now we get to our verses for today. So that's the little history of Maharaj Dushmanta, Shakuntala, and Bharat. Now Bharat is...
Maharaja...
That's a question. I don't think it is. No, because the Bharat Maharaj in the previous canto was the son of Rishabhdev, right? Was the son of Rishabhdev, the eldest of the 100 sons of Rishabhdev. And this is Dushmanta's son. But there are other Bharats too. It's like John. There are common names. Okay, so today's verse is three verses together, four verses together. We'll just read the verse. I'll read the verse, the translation. Maharaj Bharat, the son of Dushmanta, had the mark of Lord Krishna's disc on the palm of his right hand, and he had the mark of the lotus whorl on the soles of his feet. By worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead with grand ritualistic ceremony, he became the emperor and master of the entire world. Then, under the priesthood of Mamateya, Bhrigu Muni, he performed 55 horse sacrifices on the banks of the Ganges, beginning from its mouth and ending at its source, and 78 horse sacrifices on the banks of the Jamuna, beginning from the confluence of Prayag and ending at the source. He established the sacrificial fire on an excellent site, and he distributed great wealth to the Brahmins. Indeed, he distributed so many cows that each of thousands of Brahmins had one budva, which is 13,084 cows that he distributed to each of the thousands of Brahmins as his share. And this number of budva of 13,084, that's how many cows Krishna would give in charity every day from his palace in Dwarka, from all his palaces in Dwarka. He would give 13,084 cows in charity every day. So let's just focus in on these verses. So Maharaj Bharat, he performed many horse sacrifices and in different parts of India, all from the Ganges and all along the Jamuna. So these are not simple little fire jagas. These are great, grand ritualistic ceremonies that take immense wealth to perform each one. Each one. So that's how wealthy he was. So not only was he wealthy, but by performing these, he actually accrued more wealth, because he was enacting the purificatory procedure for that time. In this age, the way to purify the living entity is the chanting of Hare Krishna. It's the recommended procedure for this age, as taught by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But in other ages, the procedure of purification was different. He was following the procedure for that age, and therefore it had a great effect. So did you read yet? Would you like to read a little bit of the purport and then pass it around? Do you have it up there? Oh, yeah, okay, good.
As indicated here by the word Dushmantra, Agni, Sachi, Gune, Chita, Bharat, the son of Maharaja Dushmanta, arranged for many ritualistic ceremonies all over the world, especially all over India on the banks of the Ganges and Yamuna, from the mouth to the source, and all such sacrifices were performed in very distinguished places. As stated in Bhagavad Gita,
Yatta karmano nyatra loko yam karma bandhana,
work done as sacrifice for Vishnu has to be performed, otherwise work binds one to his material world. Everyone should engage in the performance of yagna, and the sacrificial fire should be ignited everywhere, the entire purpose being to make people happy, prosperous, and progressive in spiritual life.
Very important point. Don't skip over that point. So what was the point? What's the purpose of performing yagya?
To make prosperous, happy, and
and what else? Yeah, the purpose of performing yagya is that other people become happy and prosperous in spiritual life. They make progress in spiritual life. That's the point of yagya. Zach?
What would be done with the carcasses of all the
chakras? When in that day and age, when the horse would be sacrificed, it wasn't so, the sacrifice, the yagya, wasn't so much to kill the horse or the cow. It was to actually prove the efficacy, how efficient the Vedic mantras were by these. And so the horse would be elevated right in front of people's eyes. He would take a new birth and a higher birth. And that would prove that the mantra was being performed properly. What happened to the carcasses or the leftover body? That I don't know. Specifically, but just like sometimes the Kshatriyas sometimes they actually even eat meat, but I don't know if they did it in that case. But
the question was, were they still very pious where everyone was vegetarian?
Totally. You know, but still, even in a situation like that, under certain circumstances, which I admit publicly that I don't know all the circumstances, the Kshatriyas were allowed to eat meat under certain circumstances. But it's not, and Prabhupada often, he would very quickly point out, that, but it wasn't that they opened slaughterhouses, you know, and mercilessly killed them, and someone else killed them, and all you get is, anyway, I don't even go there, you know, but, you know, if, in certain circumstances, then if the animal was hunted properly, because there's other stories in the Bhagavatam when the animal was hunted and it was improper, they couldn't use the body for the animal for the sacrifice. There has to be so many ways. So Prabhupada often talks about the killing of cows, or let's say in this age, he said, just let the cows die naturally. And then if you take the carcass and the meat, and that's not so bad. You're not sinful for that. And the cow's skin can be used as leather and so many, it can be utilized in so many ways. The horns from the cow are used as bugles. You know, when Krishna, Shyamasundar in Alatra, he has one bugle. You do? Okay, he has one bugle from a horn. From a horn from a cow that was killed and that died in Alachua. He died naturally there, and so he took his horns and we polished them up and we gave them to Krishna for his little bugle horn. You know, so they're used in so many ways. Nimai Pandit? The purpose of the sacrifice, isn't it to please Krishna? Yes. The yagyakto kamano nyatra. That all sacrifice is meant, all activities are meant to please Krishna. And so in different times and in different circumstances, in different ages, there's different recommended procedure for pleasing Krishna. At that time, that was the recommended procedure. And as we'll read further on, it's going to come up soon, I think, in the next few sentences, that in this age is a different procedure meant to please Krishna. Is that pleasing Krishna? Yes, that is pleasing Krishna. Because why? Because the material world is meant as a means to reform people so that they can make spiritual progress and get out of here and go back to Godhead. So anything that is conducive to helping people make spiritual progress, that's pleasing to Krishna. In an authorized way, that's pleasing to Krishna. Okay? But how we do it in this age will now be explained.
Of course, these things were possible before the beginning of Kali Yuga because there were qualified Brahmins who could perform such yajna. For the present, however, the Brahman Vaivarta Puranas enjoins.
Ashwamedham Gavalambam Sannyasam Palapaitrikam Devarena Sutoputtam Kalo Panchi Vivarjitai.
So these are the five acts that are not supposed to be done in Kali Yuga.
In this age of Kali, the five acts are forbidden of offering a horse in sacrifice, offering a cow in sacrifice, accepting the order of the sannyas, offering oblations of flesh to the forefathers, and begetting children in the wife of one's brother. In this age, such yajnas as the Ashwamedha Yajna and Gomedha Yajna are impossible to perform because there are neither sufficient riches nor qualified brahmanas.
So sufficient riches nor qualified brahmins, that's why that these activities are not done in this age. Sufficient riches means that these sacrifices, tons, and Prabhupada even says you couldn't even get enough ghee to perform one of these sacrifices. Tons of ghee was offered in the fire. What to speak of the giving charity to the Brahmins was, as we saw in this verse, 13,084 cows were given to each Brahmin that participated in the yajna. And then the point is that the Brahmins were so qualified that they lived such a pure life that their chanting of the mantras was perfect. And therefore, they invoked the perfection of the mantra just by their sound vibration. So we've heard the potency of sound vibration in so many different circumstances. Oh, that's why you're dressed up. And we've heard about, so in the first canto of the Bhagavatam, we heard about the potency of the Brahmastra weapon. It's a vibration. The Brahmastra weapon is a material sound vibration, but it's chanted so perfectly and has so much potency that it can create a nuclear weapon. So that's how potent these Vedic mantras are. So there's no one qualified to chant the mantras perfectly. And what to speak of, there's not even enough riches in the whole world to put together to perform them. So what to do?
This verse says, Mamateyam Purodhaya, Maharaj Bharat engaged the son of Mamta, Bhrigu Muni, to take charge of performing this yajna. Now, however, such brahmanas are impossible to find. Therefore, the shastras recommend yajna sankirtana praya rajante hi sumedasa. Those who are intelligent should perform the sankirtan yajna inaugurated by Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Krishna varnam tusha krishnam sango pangastra parshadam yajna sankirtana praya rajante hi sumedasa.
In this age of Kali, people endowed with sufficient intelligence will worship the Lord, who is accompanied by His associates by performance of Sankirtan Yajna. Yajna must be performed, for otherwise people will be entangled in sinful activities and will suffer immensely. Therefore, the Krishna Conscious Movement has taken charge of introducing the chanting of Hare Krishna all over the world. This Hare Krishna movement is also Yajna, but without the difficulties involved in securing paraphernalia and qualified brahmanas. This congregational chanting can be performed anywhere and everywhere. If people somehow or other assemble together and are introduced to chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, 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 Krishna Hare, 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 Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, 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 Rama Hare, Hare Hare, other purposes of yajna will be fulfilled.
The first purpose is that there must be sufficient rain, for without rain there cannot be any produce. Anad bhavanti bhuntani parjanyad ana sambhava. Thank you. All our necessities can be produced simply by rainfall. Kamam vavarsa parjanya. And the earth is the original source of all necessities.
In this instance, you can see how disconnected we are from real life. Because oftentimes our attitude is, when it rains, we consider it a bother. You know, oh man, it's raining, I hate the rain, or this. Because we don't make the connection of how all life is sustained through the rain, you know. Baladev?
This morning when I went outside, it rained last night.
Yeah.
So beautiful.
Yeah. So cleaned. Yeah. Yeah. And actually, in the Vedic culture, it used to rain in the evening so that no one would be bothered. You know, it would rain in the. But then explains in Krishna book, if you caught that, there's just one sentence in the Krishna book where the farmers, because it rained in the evening while the farmers were sleeping, they often thought it didn't rain enough. Krishna was providing everything through the rain, but because they didn't see it, they'd get up and think, oh, it didn't rain enough. But actually, He's providing everything, and especially, but we're so disconnected. You know, we go to the store and pick our this and that. You don't see any connection between rain and grains and rain and vegetables or anything. We have no relationship with those things. We're so, and that's why we're feeling so lost in the world, you know, because when there's nothing, you know, you don't even get your fingers dirty. Go on.
Sarva kama dugya mai. In conclusion, there in this age of Kali, people all over the world should refrain from the four principles of sinful life: illicit sex, meat eating, intoxication, and gambling, and in a pure state of existence should perform the simple yajna of chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Then the earth will certainly produce all necessities for life, and people will be happy economically, politically, socially, religiously, and culturally. Everything will be in proper order.
So it's such a nice, you know, even just hearing that, it's sort of like having a little rainfall on your brain, you know. It's so cleansing, you know. Everything will be in proper order if people take to the chanting of Hare Krishna. That's yajna. That's the yajna for this age, the sacrifice in this age. Krishna sees that he understands, you know, the whole division of time, this sign of this age of Kali Yuga. What qualification do we have? We can't even sit still, you know, let alone perform a, you know, a yajna or chant mantras perfectly or this or that. Barely, even when we hear the four regulative principles, even that's a struggle for ourselves, and it's even inconceivable that it could spread to be a worldwide phenomena, you know, the four regulative principles. It's like inconceivable. Don't you feel a little like powerless to see that that's implemented throughout the world? But we can see the effect that it's had on our life and what to speak on our little communities and everything. Just try to chant Hare Krishna purely. And the more sincerely one does that, the more peaceful one feels, and the more that peaceful atmosphere is spread to those that are nearby. But we do have to understand that we can't do it inattentively. We can't do it half-assedly. You know? You just can't think that it's going to be automatic, that I can just, you know, turn on the automatic. And think that that's going to have the same effect on ourselves or what to speak of others. Or when we go on Harinam, do you ever have that phenomenon going on Harinam and seeing that the kirtan is roaring in the center of the kirtan and everyone else is, hey, oh, is that your baby? Oh, I didn't know you. And how's your son? You know, and what did you hear that? What's your name? What's his face? And, you know, so if we can chant attentively and sincerely, just like those of you that experienced when they had the 24-hour kirtan days in Lachua, and that nice devotee, what's his name? Madhava. Madhava, he would bring everybody's attention. Chant from your heart. Chant sincerely. Try to be conscious of what you're doing. And we all felt the potency of that chanting. You know, when many people were trying to concentrate and please the Supreme Personality of Godhead by glorifying his holy name and fame and his glory and chanting his glories. It was transforming for so many people. So that's there. That potency, and that we're just really just touching the beginning surface of the potency of the holy name in a situation like that. But see how much more potent it is when it's done from the heart with sincerity. So these are, this is the glory of Srila Prabhupada, that he had such firm conviction on the potency of the holy name that he could cross the globe, you know, with nothing except that conviction in the potency of the holy name. If I just chant and glorify the Lord, then whatever results will happen are dependent upon him. But just by people hearing that glorification, their hearts will be affected. Their lives will be changed. And because he had that potency, because he had that firm conviction, he had the potency, you know. He was an instrument in carrying the potency of the holy name. So when we experience not the same, when we're experiencing different degrees of happiness from chanting, sometimes we're more attuned to our chanting and we're endeavoring more and we're chanting and praying more from the heart, then you experience a different degree of happiness than you do when the mind is racing all over the universe thinking of all the things it has to do today and all the things that it did yesterday and all the things the other person is doing and the wars in Egypt and so many things that we have to how to bring about a chanting in that prayerful mood all the time. That's our challenge. That's our challenge. How to be prayerful and sincere and in our chanting all the time. Sometimes the modes of material nature let up a little bit and it's a little easier. And more often than not, it's much more difficult. So we have to pray and plead and beg the Lord for his mercy. So in times where it is more difficult, you will actually be able to stick to the yajna. So any comments or questions? Garrison G? Can you pass him the mic?
I'm wondering, there's a somewhat homogenous quality that, okay, it's the Sankirtan yajna, but then we hear the sacrifices chanting Hare Krishna, and so one might think, let me just chant my japa and there's my sacrifice, and that's all I have to do. But we never hear Yuga Dharma, Japa, Kirtan.
Yeah. Yuga Dharma is chanting the congregational holy name.
And so, yeah, and so I'm wondering if you could speak on the correlative principle of both, how we have to do both.
We have to do both. Well, we take it from the example of Lord Chaitanya's life. Actually, Lord Chaitanya was Satchinandana Maharaj in one Japa retreat. He pointed out, you know, Lord Chaitanya, he wasn't known for his chanting of japa. You know, it wasn't that was what he was propagating, that the chanting of japa. He was propagating the congregational chanting of the holy name in so in the process of devotional service, in the process of bhakti yoga, oftentimes you just can't walk in to a kirtan. So sometimes when you walk into a kirtan and you experience the bliss of the chanting, how to sustain that bliss? That's the question. So we have our processes of sadhana bhakti or vaidhi sadhana bhakti, the processes that have been recommended. Rising early, chanting the holy name on our japa, you know, attending artiks and eating prasadam. These sadhanas or practices will help us cleanse the dirt from the heart and mind to actually, so that when we can actually attain that state all the time. So they go together. You can't neglect the congregational chanting of the holy name in favor of just bhajan, just your solitary bhajan. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj, he would say, Dushtamana. What kind of a Vaishnava do you think you are? You're thinking that you're chanting in a solitary place, but are you thinking of Krishna? You know, you're thinking, how great I am chanting these holy names. I'm almost like Haridas Thakur. You know, I'm chanting and I'm so advanced. So who's benefiting from that? You know, obviously not even ourselves are benefiting very much. We're benefiting, but not very much. So he would call that solitary bhajan cheating. It's cheating because all you're actually really wanting is pratistha, adoration and respect from innocent public. You know, oh, here's a great yogi. But at the same time, we have our prescribed numbers of rounds to chant daily, our minimum numbers of rounds to chant daily, because we need to purify the heart. We have so much residual, the results of so many sinful activities have covered our mind and intelligence and our consciousness to such a degree that we can't even see Krishna when we're standing in front of him. We can't even appreciate his form when we're standing in front of him. So all of those practices, the chanting of japa and everything, are meant, our sadhanas, our practices meant to purify the heart, to bring us to this higher stage. And they can't be neglected because they've been given to us by the great acharyas.